clothing outfit, RFHCO, an airtight, liquid-proof, vapor-proof, fire-resistant combination of gear designed to protect them from the oxidizer and the fuel. The men called it a REFCO. A REFCO looked like a spacesuit from an early 1960s science fiction movie. It had a white detachable bubble helmet with a voice-actuated radio and a transparent plexiglass face screen. The suit was off-white, with a long zipper extending from the top of the left shoulder across the torso to the right knee. You stepped into the REFCO and wore long johns underneath it. The black vinyl gloves and boots weren't attached, so the REFCO had roll-down cuffs at the wrists and the ankles to maintain a tight seal. The suit weighed about 22 pounds. The REFCO backpack weighed an additional 35 and carried about an hour's worth of air. The outfit was heavy and cumbersome. It could be hot, sticky, and uncomfortable, especially when worn outside the air-conditioned silo. But it could also save your life. The Stage 2 oxidizer pressure cap was about two-thirds of the way up the missile. In order to reach it, Powell and Plum had to walk across a retractable steel platform that extended from the silo wall. The tall, hollow cylinder in which the Titan II stood was enclosed by another concrete cylinder with nine interior levels, housing equipment. Level 1 was near the top of the missile, level 9 about 20 feet beneath the missile. The steel work platforms folded down from the walls hydraulically. Each one had a stiff rubber edge to prevent the Titan II from getting scratched, while keeping the gap between the platform and the missile as narrow as possible. The airmen entered the launch duct at level 2. Far above their heads was a concrete silo door. It was supposed to protect the missile from the wind and the rain and the effects of a nuclear weapon detonating nearby. The door weighed 740 tons. Far below the men, beneath the Titan II, a concrete flame deflector shaped like a W was installed to guide the hot gases downward at launch, then upward through exhaust vents and out of the silo. The missile stood on a thrust mount, a steel ring at level 7 that weighed about 26,000 pounds. The thrust mount was attached to the walls by large springs so that the Titan II could ride out a nuclear attack, bounce instead of brake, and then take off. In addition to the W-53 warhead and a few hundred thousand pounds of propellants, many other things in the silo could detonate. Electro-explosive devices were used after ignition to free the missile from the thrust mount, separate Stage 2 from Stage 1, release the nose cone. The missile also housed numerous small rocket engines with flammable solid fuel to adjust the pitch and the roll of the warhead mid-flight. The Titan II launch complex had been carefully designed to minimize the risk of having so many flammables and explosives within it. Fire detectors, fire suppression systems, toxic vapor detectors, and decontamination showers were scattered throughout the nine levels of the silo. These safety devices were bolstered by strict safety rules. Whenever a PTS team member put on a REFCO, he had to be accompanied by someone else in a REFCO, with two other people waiting as backup, ready to put on their suits. Every Category 1 task had to be performed according to a standardized checklist, which the team chief usually read aloud over the radio communications network. There was one way to do everything. And only one way. Technical Order 21M LGM 25C 212 Figure 218 told Powell and Plum exactly what to do as they stood on the platform near the missile. Step 4, the PTS team chief said over the radio. Remove airborne disconnect pressure cap. Roger, Powell replied. Caution. When complying with Step 4, do not exceed 160 foot-pounds of torque. Over-torquing may result in damage to the missile skin. Roger. As Powell used a socket wrench to unscrew the pressure cap, the socket fell off. It struck the platform and bounced. Powell grabbed for it, but missed. P Plum watched the 9-pound socket slip through the narrow gap between the platform and the missile, fall about 70 feet, hit the thrust mount, and then ricochet off the Titan II. It seemed to happen in slow motion. A moment later, fuel sprayed from a hole in the missile, like water from a garden hose. Oh, man, Plum thought. This is not good. New Wave. Earlier that day, Second Lieutenant Alan D. Childers had gotten out of bed around 5, showered, put on his uniform, kissed his wife goodbye, grabbed his overnight bag, and headed for the pre-departure briefing at Little Rock Air Force Base. Childers was the deputy commander of a Titan II missile combat crew. At 7 o'clock every morning, the crews about to pull an alert gathered in a large room at the headquarters of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing. The 308th operated 18 Titan II launch complexes in Arkansas, each with a single missile and a 4-man crew. The wing's motto was Non Sibi Sed Alis, not for self, but for others. While senior officers and staff stood in the front of the briefing room, each combat crew sat at its own small table. Childers took a seat with his crew. Captain Michael T. Mazzaro was the commander, a brilliant young officer from Massachusetts, about 5'8", with thinning brown hair. Staff Sergeant Rodney L. Holder was the missile systems analyst technician, the one who made sure the missile was always ready to go. He looked a lot like Childers, tall and thin, with fair hair and glasses. Staff Sergeant Ronald O. Fuller, handsome and baby-faced, from Elmira, New York, was the missile facilities technician. His job focused on the workings of the launch site. Once or twice a week, the four of them began their days at one of these briefings and then spent the next 24 hours together underground, monitoring their missile, supervising maintenance at the site, constantly practicing, training, and awaiting the order to launch. Childers hardly fit the stereotype of a war-mongering Strategic Air Command, SAC officer, eager to nuke the Soviets and bring on Armageddon. For about a year before joining the Air Force, he'd been a late-night radio DJ who played mainly acid rock, spent his days surfing, and had hair down to his shoulders. He wasn't a hippie, but he also wasn't harboring any lifelong ambition to become a spit-and-polish military officer. He'd spent most of his childhood on the Japanese island of Okinawa, where his father was an aircraft maintenance mechanic for the Air Force. The family home was a Quonset hut.